This is the College Checklist Podcast, episode 40.
Confused about the road to college? Don't know where to begin your college search? You're in the right place. This is the College Checklist Podcast, your source for great guidance on how to get into college. And now, here's your host, Lauren Gaggioli.
Hello, and welcome to the College Checklist Podcast, brought to you by HigherScoresTestPrep.com. This is the podcast dedicated to guiding you through the complex world of college admissions. My name is Lauren Gaggioli, and I will be your host. We've got another great episode for you lined up today, but before we get to the interview, I just want to let you know that we had a little bit of technical difficulty on the front end of this interview. We had some kind of audio issues, so I've cleaned it up as much as I could, but just know it gets better about 2 minutes in, we're good. So if you need to fast forward, if you're one of those people that drives you up a wall, I totally get it. No worries. Go ahead, skip forward. The message is definitely worth hearing. Let's get to it. Our guest today is Jay Beninov, an independent college counselor and co-founder of the College Advisors Network. A self-professed recovering lawyer, Jay has practiced law and helped run successful businesses for over 30 years. He believes in helping families find the right academic, social, and financial fit. Jay, thank you so much for coming on the College Checklist today. How are you?
I'm fine. It's a pleasure being here.
Well, I am very happy to have you. So before we dive into sort of your philosophy on academics, I'd love to know a little bit more about your background and how you got into college counseling.
Well, first of all, I'm a parent myself. I have three boys. Apparently, I don't do girls very well, so I got three boys, all of whom have graduated successfully from college. Two of them are finished, in fact, with their master's. I'm married to a recently retired fifth grade public school teacher, so we have a lot of education in our family. I am still in practice law, although I try very hard not to. It was a great field, but at some point it's time to do something else. Also ran an insurance company for about 14 years and served 10 years on the St. Paul's Council. And I have been a college counselor for the last 9 years. And I think it's important to tell the audience how I got into this originally. It was sort of an accident, but when my oldest son, now 33, started this college search process, I went into his college counselor at a private school here in St. Paul, Minnesota. And she'd done a pretty good job in identifying some schools that Jesse, my son, would probably fit. And when I asked her, well, what is it going to cost me? How much is it going to cost me $7,000? Her response was, we don't know. I said, what do you mean don't know? Well, that's not the way college works. You just apply and then you get financial aid and you hope for the best. That seemed a little odd to me because, you know, college is I discovered later, the second largest investment you'll make in your lifetime. Your house might be your first. But you're going to spend a lot of money on college, especially if you have a one-on-one child. So it occurred to me there's got to be a better way than just throwing darts at a dartboard and hoping they land in the right place. And I thought about this problem for a couple of years and did some research and discovered there actually is a way to make some pretty good ballpark estimate of what you're going to pay. So that's really spurred me on to or into getting into this business. Really, my own frustration with the fact that nobody could tell me what college is going to cost. And I've been doing it about ten years now, and I love it. It's been very very, very rewarding, and really there are strategies that people can use to figure out what it is they're going to pay, and more importantly, not get into debt. We can talk more about that as we go along.
Absolutely, yes. I think, you know, it's when I was speaking with Wendy David Gaines, I asked her what she thought the biggest stressor was for students, and she said it's a four-letter word. Cost. And so it sounds like you really address that need.
Yeah, I think that's true. When I run a family, some of them are in college or something out of college, which of course at that point may be too late to reduce the debt. Or even high school students, as they think about going to college, when you talk cost, you can see it on their face. They are really stressed out. Actually, one of the most common reasons that students drop out of college is because of the cost. They get to the point where they can't afford it anymore, they can't take any more loans, and so it's probably the number one reason that students drop out of college before getting their degree.
Wow. I hadn't realized that. That's crazy. So why don't we go ahead and get straight into talking a little bit about your philosophy? We've talked about the cost side. What is it that you're looking to find for a family when you are working together towards college admissions?
Well, what I tell families is look for the right college. And by the way, there's more than one right college for every student. It's not like you have to find the one right college out of the 3,000 or so that there exist for your colleges. But the right college or right colleges is really, it's analogous to a three-legged stool. What I mean by that is the right college has to have the right academic fit. So it has to have what the student's looking for, the program the student's looking for. It has to be the right challenge. You know, you don't want to send a student to school where he's not going to study or she's not going to study, or it's going to be too difficult. Number two, right social fit. Is it the right size school? Is it a big school, a small school? Does the student want sports, not interested in sports, a student on fraternities, sororities, that kind of thing. And is the general personality of the school fit the student? Because ultimately, you know, you're not just going to school, you're really living there. If you're living on campus or around campus, this becomes your community. And certainly third, but not least, in fact, probably more important in the last 10 years than ever before, is the cost. Can you afford it? If you've got all three of those things, I think the chances of students succeeding are very, very high. If you're missing any one of those things, I think it's like a three-legged stool. You take out one of the legs of the stool, and what happens? You're going to topple over. So it's really those three. It's the academic, the social, and the financial thing. I think if you find those three, you've really hit a home run. And, you know, as I said, the cost is becoming a bigger concern than ever before. Catchphrases I use is get a degree, not debt.
So, excellent.
You know, I wish I could say that everybody is going to get out of school without some debt. It's much harder than it was. The trick is getting out of school with manageable debt.
Sure. Okay. So, you know, I was going to ask what you think, like which element should families start with when they're beginning their college search? Because I think should it be a holistic approach or should you be pinpointing, okay, what can I afford first or what is the right academic fit and then breaking it down from there?
Well, I think it is holistic. I mean, it's hard to really focus on one because you focus on one at the beginning to exclude the other two. You might be so invested in the school that you're just not looking at it clearly. So I think it's all three. I think it's important to know what you're going to pay. Well, let me put it this way. College is one of three things that I can think of, and maybe more, one of three things in terms of cost, at least, that you don't know what you're going to pay for up front. The other two things I can think of are, you know, medical. Sometimes if you need medical procedure, how many people ask the doctor, what's this going to cost me? And the other thing is raising children. When you have a child, you really don't know what it's going to cost you, how much it's going to cost you, but you just do it, hopefully out of love, which all those parents have done. So from the cost perspective, I think it's important to understand what it is you're looking at. And from the other two perspectives as well, I think it really is holistic. You need to look at everything, not to the exclusion of any of the other two components. So it really is holistic. What's going to make the student chance of success greater? And I think you need to look at all three pieces as you go through the process.
Great. So as students begin this search process, what tools should they be using to find these colleges?
Well, you know, there are a lot of tools out there. In fact, the problem is sometimes there are too many tools, so I think it's important to recognize which ones are good and which ones might not be so good. But let me talk about a couple of them. Maybe the best tool is the college itself. I'll talk about a couple of others. What I mean by college is, you know, it's important to understand the kind of student that the college is looking for. Where does the student fit into that college profile? An example, you know, if you've got a 3.5 GPA and a 30 ACT, that's a pretty good that's a pretty good student. However, you know, if you're applying to school where the average GPA is a 3.8 and the average ACT is a 33, while you're a good student, you know, the school is probably not necessarily the right school for you in terms of cost. And it might be the right term, the right school in terms of social or financial. So I think the best tool is the school itself. I think going onto the school website or some other websites, which we can talk about later, and asking the school, what's the typical student? What's the average GPA? What's the average ACT or SAT, if the student's taking SAT, that the students get at this school? And then from there, looking at some of the other tools that exist. There's a website that's that I often use. It's called DIY College. I'm just blanking on it now. It'll come to me in a second.
Okay.
But you can use collegeboard.com. You can use a variety of other sources, collegedata.com, those kinds of things. And they have a lot of information about the kind of student that is accepted to and gets aid from these particular schools. So I think there's a whole host of tools that, if you're not careful, if you're looking at 20 of them, you might get overly confused. But I think it's important to understand what the school that you're applying to is looking for. Are you the kind of student that school is looking for? I had a student a few years ago that wanted to be in marching band, because we were in marching band here in high school, and he wanted to major in engineering. Well, you know, what schools have an engineering program and a marching band? I found Carnegie Mellon really fit that student well. It was a good student. Carnegie Mellon had a marching band, and of course, it's an engineering school. And for that student, that's the right fit. Might not have been for somebody else, but for that student, he ended up with a fairly generous financial aid package.
Excellent. Great. So let's kind of continue down that road. Let's talk about reducing this debt load. You just mentioned financial aid. You know, I think historically it's sort of what you described at the beginning. Families think, you know, I'll save as much as I can, you know, and then I'll borrow the balance. And what will that be? I have no clue. So what are some of the resources that families can leverage to help sort of reduce that out-of-pocket cost for college?
Well, let me first say, as much as families want to and try to save money for college, my experience is it's not that common. Some certainly do, but the fact of the matter is we all have bills to pay. We have, many of us have mortgages. You have to feed our children, all sorts of expenses. And it's hard to think about saving for college when your child is born or when they're 8 or 10, because you're just trying to meet the daily expenses of life. So it's really difficult for families, also given the fact that the cost of college has increased so rapidly over the last 10 to 20 years. It's almost overwhelming to families to think about, well, I can't save anything. So the truth is most families have not saved very much for college. And when they get to that point, I think that's where they begin to get stressed out. The good news is there are options, I think, for the family. The first one that I often tell my families is, look for a college that gives merit aid, okay, as well as need-based. All colleges will give you need-based aid. I'm not going into a lot of detail. That's a formula that's determined by either the FAFSA or the CSS profile.
Okay.
And those are two forms that schools use. But that's a formula. There's not much you can do about that. The second piece, though, is merit aid. Now, one of the questions the families, I think, should ask every college that their student's looking at is, do you provide merit aid? Because many schools do not. Many schools only need based aid. What that means is if you're a family that has a lot of need based on the FAFSA or the CSS profile formula, you might get a really generous financial aid package. But if you don't, if you're like a typical middle-class family, you don't have as much need as you think you do, then you have to look at the school that provides merit aid. So ask the school, do you provide merit aid, right? Merit aid is different than need-based. It has nothing to do with your income. It has to do with the fact that the school wants your particular student for a variety of reasons. If your student fits their profile, you might find yourself with a large grant financial aid package from the school. I've seen 20, 30, 40. I had one student this year who got $43,000 to go to school in the Northeast, and that was an merit package, not need-based.
Wow.
So that's the first question I would ask any school. Do you provide merit aid, number one? If they do, is your student going to get that merit aid? How do you know? Again, pretty tough. But the thing I would suggest is, number one, look at some of these websites. Go to collegedata.com, for example. There you can see what the typical or the range of students are. What's the average GPA? What's the range of GPA? What's the range of the standardized test scores? And if your student is in the top quarter to a third of the entering freshman class, there's a pretty good chance that student's going to get the merit aid that you're looking for in order to be able to pay. You know, the sticker price in most private colleges is really not a very useful indicator of what you will pay. It's really the starting point, like buying a car. No one pays sticker price. But you need to know sort of where you're starting. So if the student is in the top quarter of the entering freshman class, they're likely to get money. If they're not, they may get a financial aid package that is all loans, which is what we're trying to avoid here.
Sure.
So as much as students think, I have to go to the most elite school in the country, the truth of the matter, if it's a reach school, they may get in, but they may not be able to afford it. So look for a school where you are going to be highly desired. And there are lots of really great schools in this country that students go to that are very generous. You have many in California, in the Midwest, all over the country.
Absolutely.
So I think the merit aid becomes very, very, very important. So most families don't even know how to answer that question. They don't even realize that some schools are only need-based. So I'll give you a couple of examples right here locally in Minnesota. We have two really fine liberal arts colleges, McAllister College and Carleton. Probably two of the better liberal arts colleges in the country. Well, Carleton is all need-based. McAllister provides merit aid. So if a student can get into one, may not be able to afford Carleton, but might be able to afford McAllister. And that's a question that you need to ask in order to sort of deal with the fact that you may not have saved a lot of money. So merit aid becomes very, very, very critical. There are some colleges, I can think of one offhand, Miami University in Ohio. I like what they do. You go onto their website, and there's a grid that says if you have a GPA of X and an ACT or an SAT of Y, your merit aid is going to be this.
That's
really,
nice.
Really clear. Really clear.
And are those,
unfortunately.
Jay, are those the two main criteria for financial aid, merit-based financial aid?
They are. They're not the only criteria. Some schools or many schools will look at outside activities. What have you done? What's your extracurricular been? Have you volunteered? So there's a variety of other factors they look at. I think GPA is probably the most important for many schools. Some schools don't even consider an ACT or SAT. They're called test optional schools.
Right.
But in many cases, those are the two most important. But I had a student a few years ago who was trying to get into a school. He did not have the grades or the test scores, but he had something quite unusual. He had, for 2 years in high school, he had gone over to Africa to work with his uncle, who was in Doctors Without Borders, and he helped set up medical clinics. Pretty unusual. Now, most of the students don't have that, but that was such an incredible extracurricular activity that he got into the school and got a good financial aid package because he had done something pretty unique.
Interesting.
So I think it's important that, you know, students can get involved in outside activities, school activities. It's helpful. Not at the expense of their grade suffering. I think, you know, obviously we all want their grades to be as high as possible. But I've seen schools look at all sorts of factors so many schools have formulas. We don't know it. We don't see it. But they give you a certain number of points for your GPA, your ACT, for your extracurriculars. And one thing that a lot of people, again, don't recognize is geographic diversity. Let me mention that for a second. Lots of schools in this country are looking for students from all over the country. So if you're a school in California, you know, take Occidental or Whitman or Chapman, for example, or a school in Minnesota. They're looking for students from outside of their area. And so if you happen to be from Minnesota, which is where I am, and I'll apply to perhaps Chapman, which is where you are, mm-hmm. Chapman's going to say, huh, we don't have many students from Minnesota. We're going to give them more money to come here. So geographic diversity become for some schools is pretty important. They'll literally give you money from being outside of the area.
That's so funny. I feel like a lot of us, we know the schools that are around us, so we sort of just get locked into that unless, you know, we have wanderlust or whatnot. And I've never even considered the geographic diversity factor.
Well, I think you're exactly right. We all have, we're so focused on where we grew up that we're not aware of some other opportunities. I grew up in New York, even though I'm in Minnesota now, and I never heard of some of the really great schools out here. But they are willing to give you more money if you come from someplace else than if you come from Minnesota or, in your case, California. You know, most students, I think the percentage is like 75% of the students go to school within 100 miles of home.
Oh, wow.
You can see the pretty small number that go outside. But if you're one of those that is willing to go outside of your what I call geographic comfort zone, I think there's potential money. Quite a bit. I mean, I've seen it firsthand that there is money for some of those students. So that another strategy to use if you really haven't saved enough money, which again I think is very common. Mm-hmm. Look for schools outside of your geographic comfort zone. The other thing is, you know what? It's a nice opportunity to discover the rest of the country.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Now circling back. Sorry, go ahead, Jay.
No, I said you can always go back to your home when you graduate, but at least if you go to a different part of the country, you can meet students who perhaps have a different way of thinking or are different, but interesting. I think it's a great opportunity for students to learn about other people.
Definitely. Now, circling back to sort of this discussion of merit-based financial aid, you said some schools are solely need or primarily need, and some offer more merit than others. Is there a delineation between, say, like public universities, public schools versus private schools in terms of which one is more likely to offer merit aid, or is it just a case-by-case scenario?
It's a good question. The answer is it depends, and I'll explain that what I mean by that. Private schools are more likely to give generous merit aid packages than public schools, generally, because the private schools have been raising money for as long as they've been in existence. They have their large endowments. I mean, obviously, the largest one is Harvard, but you know, that's a tough school to get into. But so generally, the private schools give the bigger merit aid. The public schools may give some, but they're much, much, much smaller for a variety of reasons. They just don't have the endowment. Having said that, there are some private schools, many of them, in fact, that don't give any merit aid. They are some of the more elite schools, for example. But none of the Ivy League schools give any merit aid. Northwestern doesn't give merit aid. I mean, many private schools don't. Their philosophy is, look, we can't tell. I mean, if you go to Harvard, Yale, Princeton, they can't tell one smart kid from the other. They're all pretty bright. Who are they going to give merit aid to? So they make the decision to give just need-based aid. Okay. But again, there are many really fine schools that will give you merit aid. You don't have to go to the elite school in order to be successful in your life. I mean, there's studies after studies that show that you don't have to go to the top 25 ranked schools in U.S. News and World Report in order to be success. And I firmly believe that that's the case. So generally, the private schools give the merit aid, and that's where you ought to be focusing if you're looking for merit aid. Which also reminds me, most people assume that the public schools are going to be cheaper because their sticker price is cheaper. The truth is, it's not always the case. If you're looking at a school that gives merit aid in the top third or quarter of your entering freshman class, you might get enough merit aid to make going to that private school less expensive than the public university. I've seen that many, many times.
Interesting. So don't rule something out just based on sticker price.
don't rule something out based on sticker price. They may be having a fire sale for all you know. So it's, no, I would say probably three quarters of the students I work with go to private schools, and most of those, not all of them, probably 80-90% pay less than they pay to go to University of Minnesota, which is our flagship public institution, because they've gotten really good financial aid packages. Now, having said all of that, obviously there are some cases in which, many cases in which, even with the financial aid, merit aid, let's say, the grants, the money doesn't have to pay back, families still need to borrow. I get the fact that it's tough. If you got to pay $20,000-$25,000, it's still a lot of money. So how do you come up with that? My advice to families is look to the federal loans first, the Stafford loans first, for a variety of reasons. They're more flexible. There's some loan forgiveness programs later on. That's where you ought to look to get your loan money first. If you need more, some states have state loan programs. Probably should look at that. Secondly, I really try to steer families away from private college loans, like a bank loan. Mm-hmm. They tend to be less flexible. And if you've got too much debt when you get out of school, it's tough. It's tough. And those loans, those private loans, are definitely you're going to have to pay them back by hook or by crook.
Right. Now, you mentioned Stafford loans and then state loans. So are state loans in the college's state, or are they in your, if you're going out of state, is it your home state?
Well, let me explain. Minnesota, for example, has what's called a self loan program, SELF. And that you can borrow up to $10,000 a year to go to schools that participate. They're not just Minnesota schools. So they can be schools all over the country.
Oh.
Not all schools participate, but many out-of-state schools are eligible. So what I tell my families, and every state's a little different, if there is a state loan program, make sure you look at that and see if your school participates. And if not, I've also had some schools who didn't participate, who when the family approached the school, they filled out the paperwork and now participate. So it depends on the state, depends on the program, but again, those loans typically are better than the private bank loans.
Sure. And then I've heard, I don't know what it is, but I've heard the name Perkins. So I've heard Stafford and Perkins sort of set side by side. How does Perkins differ?
Well, the Perkins loan is usually for students at a lower income level. The Stafford loan loans every student, regardless of family income and assets, is entitled. So if your family makes $50,000 a year, you're entitled to a Stafford loan. If they make $5 million a year, you're entitled to a Stafford loan. You may not take it, but every student, just by virtue of the fact that they're a student, can get the Stafford loan. The Perkins loan is for students whose families are at a lower income level. So not everyone is eligible. You fill out your FAFSA and it basically tells you if you're eligible for Perkins loan. Again, low interest loan from the government. But it's you may not be eligible if your family is if their income level is too high. I should also say, by the way, if I forget, that student loans are not, for the most part, are not dischargeable in bankruptcy. So if you get out of school and you owe $100,000 and you can't pay it back, unless you're a couple of minor exceptions, you got to pay that back even if you declare bankruptcy. So you got to be really careful. Because they're going to come after you on your tax return. If your parents receive Social Security, they may find that their Social Security is garnished to a certain extent. So student loans, for the most part, you can't get rid of even if you declare bankruptcy.
Okay. And those are the government student loans. Now, are private student loans bankruptible? Not that that should be a plan, but...
No. Student loans of any sort are not dischargeable bankruptcy, government or private. Again, the government's more willing to work with you. The government student loans, you can pay back based on income. So if you're making $20,000 a year when you graduate college, they're only going to take a certain amount. You only have to pay a certain amount every month. It's about 10% of your income. So they're more flexible in terms of how you're going to pay it back. Private loans usually amortize it over 10 years, and if you took out $30,000, you got a big monthly payment. So it's either government or private loans that are not dischargeable in bankruptcy. So
okay.
There are two ways of getting out of them: permanently, totally disabled, or you die. Neither of which are very good strategies, as far as I can tell.
Better to avoid the debt to begin with, right?
I would agree. And better to avoid it before you graduate college than better know that you know what you're getting into before you get into college. Because once you're in college and out of college, that's when you have difficulty.
Yes, yes. So can you talk about deferment? Because I think,
sure.
How does that apply based on the different loans?
Well, for government loans and you're having some difficulty, you can ask the government to defer your loan. I always tell students, don't just stop paying your loan. Make sure you notify the lender. You'd be surprised how many people just stop paying and think, what's going to happen? Well, trust me, bad things will happen. So you're always better off contacting the lender, in this case, the government, if it's a staffing loan. And they'll defer it. The problem with deferral, which means you don't pay back until a certain time in the future, is the interest continues to accrue. It's not like the interest stops.
I see.
So it's added on. So if you defer it for too long, you might end up owing more money much more money than you started with. So you don't have to be careful. But again, if you've got a government loan, you can pay it based on your income. The government will work with you to make sure that you have enough on a monthly basis to pay your other expenses. But as I said, there are other programs. There are loan forgiveness programs the federal government has. For example, if you work at a nonprofit for 10 years, they will forgive a portion of your loan. If you teach in certain areas, they'll forgive a certain portion of your loan. If you're if you're a doctor and you practice in certain areas, they'll forgive a certain portion of your loan. So it's important that students check on that. If you're eligible for forgiveness, you certainly want to take advantage of that. Much harder for private loans. Private loans are pretty tough. If you owe it, you're going to pay it. That's pretty much what it comes down to.
And how does the payment plan work while a student's still in school? And how does I'm forgetting what it's called, the interest rate, how does that factor in?
Yeah, the interest rate. Good question. If it's a federal Stafford loan, there's two kinds. There's the subsidized and the unsubsidized. If you're getting a subsidized Stafford federal loan, there's no interest while you're in school. So let's assume you borrow $3,000 subsidized. You don't have to pay anything back until 6 months after you graduate. At that point, you start paying it back. And you still owe $3,000. No interest has been added on while you're in school. Okay, that's the subsidized. If you're unsubsidized, you borrow $3,000, and the interest is it's just over 4% now. It changes every year. Currently, I think it went up to about 4.6% roughly. Interest is accruing while you're in school. Now you don't have to pay it back until you're out of school for 6 months. But then when you get out, you owe $3,000 plus whatever the interest that's been added on during the time you're at school. So you owe $3,000 plus. So that's the major difference. One is interest accrues, one interest doesn't accrue on the loan. Unfortunately, you don't have a choice. You don't pick which one you get. Again, it's based on your FAFSA. They'll tell you how much you're eligible for.
Okay. Good to know. And then...
with private loans, is basically, what are the terms of the loan say? You pay it over 10 years, roughly. So people really ought to make sure they read the documents when it comes to private loans. Well, documents, you read no matter what.
Sure.
Certainly for private loans.
Excellent. So not to get super complicated, but how do scholarships factor into this?
Well, good question. Most of the money, the majority of money that students get from financial aid come from two sources. The first source is the government itself. It's the loans. Some students get grants. There are other low-income grants students get. But the second major place that students get the money is from the schools themselves. The grants, the scholarships based on either need or merit. That's the second largest. The one that's probably the least, not probably, definitely the least lucrative, if you will, is the outside scholarships that students sometimes look for. A couple things with that is I've seen statistics that show that 3 to 6% of college costs are paid for on average by these outside scholarships, which isn't very much given the fact that the college scholarships from the schools themselves is about 40% of it. When you think of the outside scholarships at only 3 to 6%, that's not very much. And if you think about the fact that if you're applying for a large scholarship like the Coca-Cola scholarship, you're one of, what, 100,000 students applying? You know, it's like winning the lottery. If someone's going to win, is it going to be you? Probably not. Probably not. So what I tell families, look, if everything else is done, if you've gotten your applications done, you know what schools you're applying to, you're pretty confident that you're going to, the essay, we haven't talked about that, I know you've talked about it in the past, but if you've got a really solid essay, everything else is done, sure, go out and look for the private loans, but don't expect a whole lot of money because I haven't seen that happen for most students. It's just, you know, I'll see a student get $500 or $1,000 for a lot of work. I'm not suggesting they shouldn't do it. I'm just saying, leave that. Make sure everything else is done as well as you can possibly do it. Yeah, the exception is if your parent is part of a local organization, employer, a union, there may be some scholarships available that not many people are applying for. My own situation, my youngest son applied for a scholarship through my wife's teacher's union. And it wasn't much money. It was $1,500. It required an essay. So he took his college essay. He made a few edits and he submitted it. He won $1,500. You know, that's a better way than spending all your time trying to write an essay for the Coca-Cola scholarship. And I don't mean to put the Coca-Cola scholarship down, but there are a lot of people applying for it. So, you know, if you have a local group, that's where you ought to focus, I believe, in your outside scholarship search. Does that make some sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, it's kind of, which way do you want to do it? Would you rather have the big lump sum of a merit aid? Would you rather have maybe small hits through scholarships? We've heard suggestions on both fronts, or some combination of the two. I mean, I think it's really dependent upon a family situation, and it's dependent on the amount of time a student has, because nobody has said winning scholarships is super easy and doesn't take any time at all. So
it does take time.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I should mention also is when you're checking with the schools about the kind of merit aid they give, make sure you understand, don't just use the term financial aid, because schools look at financial aid as loans as well.
Oh.
Ask about merit aid specifically, because we say, well, what kind of financial aid do you give? Well, we'll meet 80% or 90% or 100% of your needs, but you don't want that to be loans. You want it to be grants, as much grants as possible. Okay, let me give you just a couple quick examples. There are some schools, and you can ask this at the school that you're applying to. Some schools are very generous. Amherst College, for example, gives 92% of their financial aid as grants. Grants don't have to be paid back. It's money that I don't call free money, but you don't have to pay it back. Versus 8% of their financial aid as loans. Davidson in North Carolina is about 87% grants and 13%. Loans. Grinnell College in Iowa is about the same, 87th to 13th. On the other end spectrum, on the other end, and these aren't even the worst case scenarios, but NYU, great academic institution, 56% of their aid is in grants and about 44% in loans. And Penn State is about 34% in grants and 66% in loans. So you can see, I mean, you'd rather get the grants than the loans.
Absolutely.
So ask that question: how much of my financial aid is likely to be in grants that don't have to be paid back versus a loan? Very, very important question.
Yes, and very specific too. I think a lot of families are, again, like this. The whole reason I do this, a lot of families are overwhelmed by this. I mean, just talking about the breakdown of the loans, I mean, there's Stafford, there's Perkins, there's subsidized, unsubsidized, there's scholarships. There's so much, but if you at least have the language to ask the right questions, you can get the information you need from your institutions that you're interested in. So I love that you've helped us clarify a lot of this. And I know you also mentioned the FAFSA and the CSS, and I just want everybody to know I will be putting links to these definitions and we'll clarify it just because, you know, it was sort of a ancillary topic here today. But I'll make sure that it's all listed out there in visual form because I'm a visual learner. I need to see it. So I really appreciate you bringing all that up, though, because it is so important.
You also said something I think is really important. I want to emphasize: ask questions. Don't be afraid. You're the student or the consumer of a product. I know we don't like to think of college education as a product, but or you as a consumer. But the truth is, you are. Ask the questions. Do not be afraid to call the school financial aid office or your parents. Actually, I believe that students ought to be active participants in the financial aid process. Ask the school those questions. I've got a GPA of X, I've got an ACT or SAT of Y, I do this in my school. Can you give me some idea of what kind of merit aid I might get? You know, they should be able to give you a ballpark figure and ask the other questions you have. If you don't understand something, ask the school. You can email, you can call. You know, students today don't actually know they can pick up phones and talk to a real person on the other end. Most of them, you know, email or text. But don't be afraid to ask. You're the one who's buying a very expensive product. And the schools, I think, for the most part, will answer your questions if you ask it. So don't be afraid to ask. In fact, make sure you ask the questions of the school. You're paying the bill, so you might as well get the answer.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree with you. There's this sort of, it's education. It's not a product. But at the end of the day, if you're shelling out, you know, five figures for a product, for an education, it is a product to some degree. So, yeah, you do need to know what you're getting into. Right. Excellent. And Jay, would you mind sharing with us maybe one or two success stories just to sort of give us insight into the way you can chart a path for a student from beginning to end and how this can all come together from the financial aspect in particular?
Sure. Well, first of all, let me tell people that this is unfortunately not an easy process. It is overwhelming. And I tell my family, you know, you have to spend as much time on this as you would anything else ever. As much time as you did in buying your house, maybe more time. It's not a weekend project. It really is a project that takes some effort. But if you do it and if you do it smartly and you become a smart shopper or consumer. Let me give a couple of examples of students I work with. Really, on both ends of what I call the academic spectrum. I had one student who had a 2.6 GPA and a 19 ACT, not what you call an academic superstar. But he also wanted to major in sports management. Again, so you're shrinking the number of schools you can even look at. He went through this process and was willing to be flexible. In other words, he said, yeah, I'll leave the cold climes of Minnesota and go someplace. We found a school that cost $40,000 a year and had sports management. And even with his 2.6 and 19, he ended up with a grant of $27,000. So his family's out-of-pocket is going $13,000. Now you might ask, how did that happen? Well, we found a school in Buffalo, New York. Unfortunately for him, the weather's no better than Minnesota. He's used to Minnesota, he can handle Buffalo. But they hadn't seen a Minnesotan, as far as we could tell, in their whole life. And they were pretty excited that someone from Minnesota was willing to look at their school. But he went through a whole series of schools that and was willing to be flexible about it. So he ended up with a pretty good financial package. Another student I had on the other end of the spectrum had a 3.98 GPA and a 34 ACT. Obviously, a very different student, but ended up also willing to look broadly and leave the state. And she ended up with a package where her family's out of pocket. In other words, what does her family have to come up with every single year after you subtract the grants? It was about $1,500 a year. Now, that doesn't happen all that often, but it can happen if you're willing to do the work, ask the questions of the school, and maybe go to schools that, and when you started the process, get in Europe. Because, you know, if you grew up in California, how many students have heard of, I don't know, Carlton McAllister? You know, we have St. Olaf here.
No one.
Not, Right, that's exactly right. Exactly. But I'll tell you, when I mentioned schools out in California, Occidental or just at Whitman or Chapman or you go on and on, people look at me like, are you crazy? Where are they? But they're good institutions. There's nothing wrong with them. The other thing I think people should know, which I didn't mention, is there is a way of getting additional financial aid at the end of all this. So if student applies, if all their financial aid packages by April of their senior year, that I tell families, that's not always the end of the story. There is a way of appealing. Many schools allow appeals based on a variety of factors. I'll give you one example. I had a student this year was accepted to school in the Northeast, and some unusual circumstances, financial circumstances for the family. The family would have had to pay $41,000 to go to this school. She got a $20,000 grant, but it still wasn't enough. So we appealed it. She appealed it and ended up with an additional grant of $37,000. So on top of the $21,000 she'd already gotten. So that family goes from paying $41,000 a year to $4,000 a year.
Wow.
So, you know, and that was based on some economic circumstances. But the other thing you can do is, if you're looking at three or four schools and one school gave you a little more than the other school, you know, even though the schools frankly don't like to admit the fact that they will often match their competitor, if you send that competitor's package in, you'd be surprised. You could find yourself with another $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 a year. So don't think it's the end of the line once you get those up packages. Be willing to appeal. You have nothing to lose. The worst I can say is no more money. So what?
Yeah, that's great. Good advice. Thank you so much. Jay, I've learned so much today. Thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure.
Before we wrap up, though, we usually play the lightning round. Would you be interested in playing?
Sure, I'd love to.
Excellent. So the first question is, what is your best tip or piece of advice for families as they begin this journey?
Take a deep breath, first of all. but I think I already touched on it. Treat this like you would buying any major purchase, buying your house, buying your car, probably even more time than that. Take the time, look at the resources that are available to you, either in the library or in your school, and take time. You really can't do this, I don't think, a very good job if you start fall of your senior year. I think that gets really, really stressful. So take your time. Put some time aside and treat this like the major search and major financial commitment that it will be.
Excellent. And what is the college admissions book, blog, or tool that no family should be without?
I got a couple of them. I like the there's a website called DIYCollegeRankings.com. It's really an Excel spreadsheet, but it's full of information. You can sort, you can do all sorts of things to find the kind of school you're looking for. I like that one. I like the collegesolutions.com, which was Lynn O'Shaughnessy's blog. And one that most people don't know about is what's called the Common Data Set. The Common Data Set, every school fills out information, and it's full of information. It's incredible. But to get it, what you do is you Google the name of the school, Common Data Set. So you do Occidental Common Data Set, and you get all sorts of detail about the school. Who did they admit? How much merit aid did they give? Just full of information. So that's another good one too.
Yeah, that's not been brought up. Oh, I can't wait to dive in. Great, thank you.
So Google Common Data Set and the name of the school.
Excellent. Can't wait to dive in on that one. And then third, lots of families out there are overwhelmed by this process. So what would you encourage those families to focus on as they move forward?
Well, let me say, it's not just the families that are overwhelmed, but unfortunately, many public schools are too. Mm. I don't know what your situation is in California, but in Minnesota, we have a counselor-student ratio of 800 to 1.
Oh, we are the same.
No, great.
It's terrible, but, yeah.
So I think it's important to understand that a lot of the help has to come from elsewhere. We have, I don't know, other states, but in Minnesota, we have some organizations that provide free advice want as small a town as possible. The free advice to students as they go through their search. Obviously, the public library, lots of resources in the library to use. Maybe people who have been through this a number of times. Obviously, as independent counselors, we'd like to think that we can help students as well. But understanding that not everyone wants to go that route. I think there are other routes to go. But I think the thing you have to understand is in most states, as much as the counselors would like to help, they just don't have the time. So find help elsewhere.
Excellent. And over here at Higher Scores Test Prep, we love to read. So I'm curious to know, what is your all-time favorite book?
Well, I was a history major in college. Actually, history, political science, which, of course, where does that get you? But I love it. I love history. So, I'm sort of fanatic about it. So I guess it's things. My favorite book, as I think about it now, and it might change next week, but, Doris Kearns Goodwin, probably Team of Rivals. I mean, I love all her books, but I think Team of Rivals. And I've got a personal favorite, too. There was actually a book written about my parents and their journey in World War II, which, of course, because that's my parents, I love that book. It's called Joshua and Isadora, A Tale of Loss and Love in the Holocaust. So, obviously, that's a very personal kind of a thing. But
absolutely.
Again, that's history, and it's my family's history, so it really combines two things. But I just love Doris Kearns Goodwin. I just think she really brings history alive.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. And lastly, Jay, where can people get more of you?
If they want more of me, they certainly can.
I'm sure they're going to.
my website is probably the easiest. It's cannetmn.com. That's cannetmn.com.
Excellent.
cannetmn.com. So probably the best way to reach me.
Great. And I will definitely put a link to that in the show notes, as well as all of the resources we've just talked about. Jay, thank you again for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure. And I think you have a great service, and the speakers and the guests you've had on your show, I think, have been wonderful. And I think it's important that families understand that this is an important process. But if they listen to some of the advice that some of your guests have given, I think they'll make it through. They'll make it through, and they'll be fine. So again, thanks for having me.
Another big thanks to Jay for coming on the show today. As always, you can find the show notes for this episode over at higherscorestestprep.com/40, as in episode 40. And don't forget, our Q&A hotline is now open. The telephone number for that is 760-913-PREP or 760-913-7737. I'm really looking forward to hearing from you and answering your questions. After all, you're the reason I do this. So if there is something you want to hear covered, please, by all means, get in touch. See you on the next episode.
Thanks for listening to the College Checklist. For great college admissions tips and test prep advice, be sure to visit higherscorestestprep.com.